The Minister's Great Expectations by Reverend Donald W. Lawson, being a sermon preached in the Pullman Memorial Universalist Church of Albion, New York on March 26, 1950. For some time now, I have sensed in our church something which is hard to put into words. Perhaps the words uneasiness and impatience may best describe what I have felt. At any rate, these feelings lead me today to share with you some ideas as to the relationship that exists or ought to exist between parishioners and pastor, between you and me. I think it is time to take stock of where we are at, and perhaps more important, where we are planning to go, if anywhere. There are many things that parishioners have a right to expect of their pastor. It is fundamental and basic that a minister should be a person whose leadership commands respect. He should be heard with an open ear and an open mind, even though you may disagree with him. Now, you see how easy it is to cross the border between what a parishioner expects of his pastor and what a minister rightfully expects of his people. They are really two sides or facets of the same question. Harold S. Latham, the president of the Universalist Church of America, writing in the March issue of the Christian Leader, had this to say about what the minister had a right to expect of him as a layman. Mr. Latham is a vice president of the Macmillan Publishing Company and also a very active layman in the Universalist Church in East Orange, New Jersey. Mr. Latham was the man who discovered the famous novel Gone with the Wind. Mr. Latham writes so clearly and forcefully on this subject that I shall quote from his article at length. Then I shall make some personal observations and comments regarding our particular situation in this church today. What makes a church succeed? Or if you do not like that word, tick, come alive, be a force in the community. The answer is probably a three-headed one: the location, the minister, the people. Of these, in my opinion, the third is by far the most important. Of course, a strategic location helps, but it is, after all, the people who are the vital factor. How often have we seen a church fail, almost close its doors, in fact? Then a new man comes to the pulpit and things begin to happen. The church once more assumes a position of importance in the neighborhood and in the lives of the men and the women of its parish. The attendance picks up and the church school prospers. The easy and popular explanation is that the change in ministers is responsible for this new life and vigor, when it is really a change in the people. They are behind the new man. They were indifferent to his predecessor, perhaps for good and sufficient reasons. But anyway, they were not interested. Had they pursued the same policy with the new arrival, the church would have remained dormant. A church is really a church only when it is a going concern, regardless of the occupant of the pulpit. He is the leader, not the heart of it. His position is like the pilot of a ship. Trained in the art of navigation, he can set the course and steer the ship, but he does not supply the power. That comes from the great machines in back of him and underneath him. There is no power in the pilot house until it is harnessed to the engine room. And so with the minister. There must be back of him great forces which he can direct, but which he does not necessarily have to create. Too often, it seems to me, we expect the minister to pilot and pull, to do both. It is all very well for him to pull as much as he can, but that is not, as I see it, his major job. The pulling and pushing are primarily up to the laymen and the women. This raises the question, just what does the minister have a right to expect of laymen? The big answer to this is time. Time is the most important contribution a man or woman can make. Not merely time sitting in pews, but time pushing and pulling. This is, I believe, a greater need of the church than money. If we could secure all the working time we need, the money would take care of itself. Moreover, most of those now associated with churches give money, not as liberally as they should or could in many cases, but still they do have a part in the money end. On the other hand, how few are willing to give of that valuable commodity time? Too often, when a church officer is seeking a new worker, he is met with the response, "Oh, but I couldn't possibly do it. I haven't the time." If no one gave time to the church, what would it be? A little select lecture society. This is not the purpose of a church. We are an outreaching body, or should be, intent on bettering the lot of the human race. We wouldn't get very far at it if we were made up of lecture groups only. It is time that is the essence of church life. Time to work in the church school, time to help in the women's groups, time to give to men's programs, to service projects, to civic causes with which the church may be identified. Time to pull and push. In the consideration of time, it must be agreed that the willing worker is sometimes overworked. Too often, the same few do it all. This is bad. Bad for the few, bad for the others, bad for the church. The tasks should be passed around and shared. Those who overdo tire out after a while and can't carry on. So just because you see a job being done, don't assume that you are not needed. Carry your share of the church load. So then, the first and the biggest and the most important thing a minister has a right to ask of me is time. But there are a few other little things too. When you have suggestions, constructive ones, give them to your minister. He has a right to expect that you will. On the other hand, be wary of your criticisms. A minister is naturally a sensitive being. If he were not, he could not be a success in his chosen profession. He may hide his sensitiveness under a mask of indifference, but it's there just the same. This is not to say that when you have really important and significant criticisms, you should make them known. Indeed, you have a duty to do so, and your minister would expect it. Everything depends on the way you go about voicing your sentiments and upon the importance of those sentiments. Good fellowship. This is something else which I think the minister has a right to expect from his church. Here are men and women banded together in the pursuit of common ideals. What could be more sensibly expected than that in the process of working toward our goals? We should have a good time doing it. Yet, how frequently we fail in this respect. How many times the minister has to serve as peacemaker between groups and individuals. How often he has to spend his time trying to secure and preserve harmony instead of getting forward with important tasks. I am always emphasizing the joys of church work, the large satisfactions that come from it. I thoroughly believe it to be the most rewarding association a man can have. Much of this can be defeated, however, when harmony departs and dissension enters. The individual and the church body both suffer. Most certainly, therefore, the minister has a right to expect a happy spirit of unity. But many a parishioner forgets this, and instead of a broad consideration of the whole church, sets up his own individual feeling and judgment as the standard of the minister's duty. It is this narrow view that often leads to the kind of criticisms which have the effect of loosening the minister's hold upon his church. As one wise person has remarked, if you cannot conscientiously class your pastor as you ought among the dearest of personal friends, to stab whose reputation would be to wound yourself, then class him among your enemies and fulfill the Lord's command to pray for him. I have not by any means exhausted the possibilities of what my church and my minister have a right to expect of me. I hope I have written enough to set in motion certain thought processes of your own, which you may find helpful. Certainly, that is what has happened to me. The more I think and write about it, the larger the responsibilities of the layman appear to be. I know that I have found Mr. Latham's words very valuable to me in pointing out some of the various factors in our relationship together as parish and pastor. I certainly hope that they have been of value to you. Long before he passed away, I went one Sunday afternoon to call at the home of the late John E. Bradley. What I am going to say now, I am divulging for the first time. I have not mentioned it before, for fear that perhaps some might think I was fabricating the whole thing for effect. At that particular time, there was some talk in the parish about the condition of our church building and how it should be fixed up, especially the redecoration of the sanctuary, which, with its unsightly broken plaster. I happened to mention to Mr. Bradley that I felt badly about the condition of our building, and he replied, "So do I. But I've left things so they can fix it up. It's all in my will." Since Mr. Bradley has gone, and since we haven't inherited over $30,000 from his estate, I have been thinking more and more deeply about what he said to me that day and the actual terms of his will in regard to the residuary legati, which is the Pullman Memorial Universalist Church. I cannot state the terms exactly, but I know that Mr. Bradley left all that money to our church with absolutely no strings attached, and to be administered at the discretion of the Board of Trustees. If he had specifically wanted his money invested, would he not have so stated in the very will itself? Therefore, I am compelled to believe that Mr. Bradley wanted his money to be used for the best interests and welfare of our church. And I know that Mr. Bradley took pride in his church and deeply desired to see it put in the best of physical condition. I imagine that some of you may be saying to yourselves, "Well, Mr. Pastor, that may all be well and good, but actually, what concern is it of yours what we do with our money? And why do you care what we do with our church? After a while, you will leave, and we shall have another pastor, and then another. But the church is ours, and we remain. And what we do with it is largely our concern." And you know, if some of you may be thinking along that line, that I agree with you all the way. The matter, however, does not rest there, at least so far as I am concerned, because I think it is a matter of concern for me as the recognized spiritual leader of this church. When several of our most faithful parishioners say to me that they are becoming very disappointed at the lack of action in fixing up this church, and that if action is not forthcoming soon, they will no longer be interested. You see, such a thing puts a pressure on me to get things done, and I am sure it is a matter of concern for me as the administrator of this church when I learn that pledges for this year are not as high as they were a year ago. In fact, some have dropped their pledges entirely, while others have lowered their pledges. In only one or two instances have they been raised. Now, why are such things happening? Why are people threatening to withdraw and lowering, if not dropping, their pledges? Is it because our church has inherited the Bradley estate money? Such an obvious answer does not satisfy. I think that together with the fact that the money is not as free and plentiful as it was several years ago, we must put the fact, I think it is a fact, that some of our people are just waiting to see what is done with this inherited windfall from Mr. Bradley. If the money is practically all sunk in investments, as has been the case with nearly all bequests to the church in the past, when the church property stands in such desperate need of repair, maintenance, and improvement, these people will definitely lose interest. It is my contention that people want to belong to a going organization, a wisely considered use of a generous portion of the Bradley estate inheritance to put our church into superior condition would not only bring happiness and inspiration to the overwhelming majority of people in our parish, I believe, but would serve as an incentive to bring new blood into the church, a very desirable and needful thing all will surely agree. I have talked with a considerable number of people, and not one person has told me they oppose the use of our latest endowment money for the avowed purpose of fixing up the church. Some have asked me, what are we waiting for now? And my answer, based, I admit, largely on faith, has been summer. I hope that if you agree with the line of thought I am presenting you, you'll be vocal about letting the Board of Trustees know how you feel. We have a board composed of a fine group of people, namely Mrs. Homer Lutenton, Homer Brown, Chairman, Rance Wright, Kenneth Trussell, Harold Crowther, and Aura Lee. They are persons who feel their responsibility to you, the parishioners of the church. They want and welcome your suggestions, ideas, comments, constructive criticisms, and hope you will voice your opinions. Convinced that a dominant majority of the people of this church want action in the improvement of our property, I know they will present an outline of what they feel should be done, and it will be very worthy of consideration. I am definitely convinced that when we begin doing something definite in the way of improving our plant, that more money than ever will flow into our coffers. Why? Because, as I stated before, people want to be identified with a group or an organization that is going places and doing things. I think you ought to know that one of the leading pastors in town thinks that this church has no future. He has offered the invitation to us to end services forever in our church and unite with his church. Our church would not stand idle, but would be used as a dining room and a place for offices, according to his plan. When he told me this, I was simply astounded, and I said to him that I doubted if our people would ever hear of it. I do not oppose the union of churches in general, but to be fair, I do think such union should be on a 50-50 basis. The fact is that if every one of the people in this church voted to end services, I would still oppose it on the basis that we were being unfair to the spirit of George M. Pullman and our own Universalist forebears. But how does this whole idea of this local pastor strike you? I'd really like to know. To me, it is a challenge and an inspiration. We are very privileged. We have, and there is no doubting it, the most beautiful edifice in the whole Universalist denomination. Because it was practically handed to the people of Albion and vicinity on a silver platter, it is all the more reason why we should treasure it and make it our real pride and joy. It is said, you know, that the appearance and condition of a church building reflects the character and condition of those who support it. I ask you, in all sincerity, can we honestly be true to our consciences and let the blighting deterioration of this beautiful building go on unabated when we have the means for correcting the condition and improving our property manyfold within our grasp? I know that some say we should not touch invested funds to fix up the church, even though in many instances such funds were given expressly for the maintenance of the church. I know that most of you give generously according to your means. And if the parishioners alive today are able to meet the annual running expenses, the annual budget of the church, they are really doing their full and very fair share. I do not see how more can be expected of them. But the Bradley estate funds are not invested as yet, and I question whether the board would invest the larger share if they knew how the great majority of the parish feel. They would allocate a large share for building purposes. I could go on for hours, but the time is limited. I am so wrapped up in this matter, and it seems to be about all I am eating and sleeping and thinking and living these days. I feel terribly conscious of the fact that this church is passing through a very critical period. I honestly think that whether this church is to die out entirely or get a new and tremendously vital lease on life hangs in the balance. The decision rests with you. I pray you will stand overwhelmingly in favor of action, and I pray God for the privilege of remaining with you. But if my staying ever hinders the greatest welfare of the church, I should be the first to want to leave. I have come to love this beautiful church, its people, its history and tradition. We never willingly or consciously desire to hurt or hinder that which we love. It is getting so that I dare not mention the name of another denomination to any Universalist without emphasizing the fact that I am not planning to leave and join up with the other group. Several of my predecessors here in this pulpit and my good friend Robert E. Davis of Buffalo have precipitated this apologetic position on my part. It all reminds me of a story. The story is told that on their 50th wedding anniversary, Mr. and Mrs. Henry Ford attended a celebration given in their honor. During the interview, a newspaperman asked the auto magnate, "To what do you attribute your successful marriage?" "The formula is the same as the one used to make a successful car," answered Mr. Ford. "Stick to one model." "Well, I'd like to stick with you yet a while, and I will if you want me, and if you will glue yourselves to the needful thing. If you'd like to have the kind of church like the kind of church you'd like, you needn't stick your clothes in a grip and start on a long, long hike. You'll only find what you left behind, for there's nothing that's really new. It's a knock at yourself when you knock your church. It isn't your church, it's you. A good church is not made by folks afraid, lest somebody else get ahead. But when everyone works and nobody shirks, you can raise a church from the dead. And if, while you're doing your level best, your neighbor will do his too, your church will be what you want to see. It isn't your church, it's you.